Hey everyone, I'm Tara Lynn of Geek Saga Entertainment, and welcome to the Geek Saga Show's solo podcast series, Impulsive Hyper Focus. First things first, follow me at A Geek Saga on Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, or Threads for insight into my life and, of course, updates about this and other Geek Saga Entertainment endeavors. And if you want early access to these and other podcast-only recordings, links to personal Spotify playlists, show notes, writing samples, and more, check out the Geek Saga Entertainment Patreon at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment. If you haven't listened to my previous Impulsive Hyperfocus episodes, I always start out by highlighting one thing about myself, and with this being the first time ever that I'm doing a podcast about my travels, I think it makes the most sense for me to touch on what type of traveler I am, or maybe the type of traveler I used to be versus the one I've apparently turned into. Obviously, when I'm returning to a place that I've visited many times before, the way I go about making plans, if I make any at all, is very different than from when I'm going somewhere new. I might look into finally experiencing something that I didn't have time to do on previous visits, or looking into new restaurants or tours or whatever that have popped up since I was last there, but I don't go all out like I do for new places. For instance, buying an actual physical guidebook, which I used to do for every new place I was going on vacation to. And I didn't just flip through those guidebooks, I read them, I mean cover to cover, and marked them with color-coded tabs to boot. But I don't do that all of the time anymore. These days, I'll often just start with some basic things to do in X place type Google searches, and then do additional digging from there depending on what the sightseeing and or tour options are. So while I kind of went from a plan nearly every moment of every day traveler back in my 20s and 30s, I've been a bit more laid back about that in recent years. That and packing, because I used to start packing days, if not a week or more in advance, and lately I have just been throwing things into a suitcase the night before I leave because I'm a weirdo who gets anxious about my dogs seeing me packing and them getting anxious. And no, I'm not exaggerating about the dogs. I will even try to hide my packing from them by doing it while they're outside in the backyard, if at all possible. Anyway, while me not being quite the planner that I used to be hadn't really been an issue on the vacations I've taken in recent years, and in fact served me quite well at times, such as a road trip we took to wine country and down the Pacific Coast Highway to Solvang a couple of years ago. Turns out that when in Japan, I very quickly started missing my old way of doing things, and it's due to that revelation that I'm going to truly kick off this episode with Chapter 1, Best Laid Plans and All That. It seemed best to begin at the beginning and talk about the planning that went into this trip, or lack of it, maybe, because I'll be honest, this chapter title is, well, kind of facetious. I used to plan overseas trips, or really most vacations period, very far in advance. For instance, the last two trips I took to Europe were planned close to or more than a year in advance. Granted, this one was still kind of far out, insofar as we were talking about going to Japan for the past couple of years, and then early in 2024 decided that November of this year would probably be best. And then when I started actually looking at flights and the time changes and considering how much time off we could actually take, our best bet ended up being to fly out the day after Thanksgiving, thus allowing us to stay for about 8 full days while still only actually taking 5 days off work. And speaking of booking flights, that was a little bit of a nightmare at first, and this is very much a first world problem sort of thing, but I was using credit card points that I had saved up, by the way, for many, many years, and many airlines that were showing up in the rewards search for my particular credit card wouldn't let me reserve or even request seats via the rewards website. Thankfully, I eventually found direct flights from LAX that worked in terms of how many points I had, that also had good departure and arrival times, and I was at least able to request the seats on the rewards site and then immediately call the airline to make sure they were confirmed. Though, don't get me wrong, every 4 to 6 weeks or so from when I booked those flights until we left, I signed in to make sure that United hadn't messed with anything. Because, boy, can I tell you some United Airlines horror stories. Anyway, to dig into the main reasons why this chapter title is a bit facetious, as I said, despite being very type A, to be honest, I didn't do as much pre-planning as I should have. Definitely nowhere near as much as I did for past overseas trips. And on top of that, most of my more, quote, solid, unquote, planning for this one happened less than a week before we left and was also just pretty rushed in general. And I have no one but myself to blame for that. To rewind a bit, I did buy 2 guidebooks several months in advance. One was Lonely Planet Tokyo, and the other was actually called What Not to Do in Japan. And I started with reading the Tokyo guidebook, but after going through about 2/3 of it, I think, I paused to read the What Not to Do one because I was getting so overwhelmed by everything I wanted to see just in Tokyo alone. Problem is, I ended up regretting reading the What Not to Do book because it made me want to see and do things I knew we wouldn't have time for. Ugh. Namely, Hiroshima. But no, we didn't even make it to Kyoto, which is the city that's most commonly paired with Tokyo on a shorter trip to Japan. This was a personal choice that I both do and do not regret. I do regret it a bit because who knows if or when we'll ever make it back to Japan, but I also don't regret it a ton because we still got to see so much, including almost everything I really wanted to see in and around Tokyo itself, all of which I will get into in later chapters, of course. So anyway, that's kind of the shortest version of the story that I can give as to why the reading of the guidebooks, such as it was, is part of this best or maybe not so best laid plans discussion. But a slightly more frustrating situation was the communication issues, which again, entirely my fault. However, I didn't do nothing about them. Or maybe I should reword that and say that I tried to do something about them because, duh, of course, I knew ahead of time that the language barrier would be much bigger than it ever was on my trips to Europe. So in hopes of combating that, about 7.5 months prior to our trip, I signed up for Super Duolingo in hopes of learning enough of the basics to help at least a little bit. Problem is, while I learned a lot in 7.5 months, during which I usually did about 20 to 30 minutes worth of lessons each day, most of it wasn't really the things one needs to know as a traveler. Basically, I definitely should have spent way more time learning the writing systems, especially kanji, as well as more basic phrases, versus the innumerable hours spent on, say, describing families and homes, talking about hobbies and the like. Obviously, I was never going to be even like 20% on the way to any sort of fluency. But yeah, I do wish I'd started way earlier and maybe looked for a program that focused more on what I should learn for travel purposes. However, I'm not totally giving up on Japanese. I am currently focusing more on polishing my French, but I'm still taking a few Japanese Duolingo lessons a week, and I bought some kanji starters in Japan so that all that time I did spend trying to learn Japanese maybe doesn't totally go to waste. We'll see. Okay, don't want to get totally off track, so on to the next planning snafu. To be fair, this one was not my snafu. I suppose technically you could say it was Dean's, but then again, not really. This one has to do with the fact that we both double-checked our cell phone carriers and made sure that we would have service in Japan prior to leaving. Now, I have Verizon, and while this wasn't the cheapest option, I don't even know if it was the cheapest option with Verizon, but I'm sure it also is not the cheapest option across cell phone carriers in general. I was able to sign into my Verizon account and just use their chatbot to make sure my international roaming was turned on for countries other than Canada and Mexico. It was a daily charge that covered a full 24 hours, and it only kicked in if I actually used it. And the first time I tried to use my phone off Wi-Fi on our first evening, sure enough, it just worked. Now, I won't go into all of the drama that Dean dealt with or all of the hoops he had to jump through to get his phone to work. Needless to say, though, if you have T-Mobile and your plan doesn't already include international roaming or data or whatever they call it for countries outside of Canada and Mexico, all I can say is good luck. The TLDR version is that it wasn't until late morning on our second full day, I believe, that his phone was finally working, and that was after hours. Yes, hours of time spent on the phone with T-Mobile those first two mornings. And the cherry on top was that he signed up for a certain amount of data, used that up 2 days before we were heading home, and never got any sort of warning from them that he was close to doing so, which meant a couple of pauses in our day at Disneyland, of all places, as he used my phone as a tether to get someone on a T-Mobile help chat who could get him more data. Meanwhile, my usage was unlimited, and I got a warning every day about what time it would kick over to charging me for the next 24 hours. And listen, I'm not one to brag about or shit on cell phone carriers, because if you ask me, they're all meh in one way or another. But in this case, Verizon for the win for sure. However, as much as I say I'm not one to go off one way or another about carriers, I am an iPhone person. An Apple person in general. And yes, I know they're problematic, but come on, what tech company isn't? That said, as an iPhone person, I don't ever bother arguing with Android users. At best, I roll my eyes and go on with my life when they start bragging about how much better Androids are than iPhones. But ha ha ha, in Japan, the joke's on you, Android users, because Japan is very iPhone friendly, but apparently not so Android friendly, to the point where there are things that one can use an iPhone for that simply don't work on an Android, except in some cases where if you bought your Android in Japan, you might be okay. I bring this up at this point in my little trip recap here because, of course, I researched the best options for things like paying for public transportation in Japan, and because we iPhone users are constantly dealing with our Android-loving friends bashing iPhones, I assumed that if something would work for me, it would work for Dean on his Android phone as well. Nope. Granted, the only specific example I have to give off the top of my head is the Suica card, and I might not be pronouncing that correctly, but it's S-U-I-C-A. So I'm just going to say Suica and assume I'm right, because I'm not going to go back and look it up right now as I'm recording this. But the Suica card is technically a transportation card that you can add to your phone, in my case, Apple Wallet, and load money onto to pay for subway, train, and I believe tram and bus rides. Plus, you can also use it to pay for things in a lot of places such as konbinis, aka convenience stores, more on those later. So I added the Suica card to Apple Wallet on my phone and put a few thousand yen on it to start, but then it turned out that Dean had no such option because, as mentioned, he has an Android that, you know, obviously wasn't purchased in Japan. So this made things a bit tense at first, because while you can buy cards that are good for certain subway lines at just about any machine in the stations, they aren't good for the JR lines or even some of the little local lines. And listen, it's not that this would have made it impossible for us to get Dean the tickets he needed wherever we needed to go one way or another, but who wants to have to be figuring that out even once a day when the person you're traveling with can just tap their phone and then load more money onto it in increments of 1,000 yen whenever they need to? Just saying. Thankfully, the solution wasn't that big of a deal. While we missed the chance to get Dean a physical Suica card at the airport due to, I guess, my poor planning, cough, aka my assumption that those androids everyone brags about could do anything an iPhone could do in Japan, cough, you can actually get these cards in the travel/tourist offices of several major train stations, including the one that was closest to our hotel. And while I'm talking about transportation, I might as well move on to chapter 2, planes, trains, and automobiles, or all things transportation. I am going to rewind a bit here and actually start by talking about the planes portion of our trip, because there isn't really much to say about it anyway. It had been more than 13 years since I flew overseas, and originally it looked like these would actually be longer flights than any previous one I'd taken. But whether it's age making time seem to pass faster, or me just being overly used to lengthy travel days and or flights because I've been going back and forth across the country every couple of months for several years now, our Los Angeles to Tokyo flight and back kind of felt like nothing. The flight there was longer than the one home, right about 12 hours versus a little less than 10. And the timing of it was weird enough that I didn't sleep at all on the way there, because we took off around 11:30 a.m. Pacific, which meant it only felt like about 11:30 p.m. our time when we landed. We did pay for Economy Plus for both legs, but go figure that the outbound one, where I wasn't tired enough to even attempt to sleep, was the one where we actually got lucky and had a set of three seats to ourselves. Meanwhile, on the flight home, we had aisle seats across from each other, and Dean got lucky with the middle seat next to him being empty, but I was next to a couple, and the guy was in the middle. Obviously, he got the armrest to my left, but he also kept encroaching on my space. Like, first he was leaning toward me, even though the girl he was with was definitely his significant other. And then later, when he leaned on her while he was sleeping, let's just say that a decent portion of him was squeezed under that armrest and into my seat. Anyway, they also fed us a lot, but I somehow kept getting hungry despite that. The food was airplane food, so it's not like it was great, but I was eating basically all of it, and I'm still confused about that because when I'm sitting around at home working or even just chilling on weekends, I often kind of forget I should eat until like 8 hours have passed and I realize, huh, that's a thing I should probably do. So maybe it was a boredom thing on the flights? Okay, that's essentially a rhetorical question. I said I wasn't going to go on and on about our flights, and I've probably already done that way too much. So I'm going to talk about our arrival to Japan and the dumb decision I made for us to take a bus to the hotel. Or, well, not even to the hotel, to the train station near our hotel. The bus directly to that station was only, I don't know, at most $5 more per person than taking trains or subways would have been. But I thought, what the heck, it's worth the extra money because otherwise we would have had to switch trains at some point with all of our luggage, of course. I will give the woman at the bus ticket counter this. She sold us tickets for the next available bus to Shinjuku, but did explain that it would be dropping us off an 8 to 10 minute walk from our hotel, whereas a different bus leaving over an hour later would drop us off just a block or so away, I think. But I didn't want to wait around the airport for an hour and figured the streets are flat. It's a Saturday evening, so there won't be rush hour level crowds. An 8 to 10 minute walk is no big deal, even with our luggage. And listen, it wouldn't have been. But despite being tall, long-legged people who are fast walkers, even without luggage, that was not an 8 to 10 minute walk. Closer to 20, we learned as much when we walked that same route a few times throughout the week. And that closer to 20 was when we both actually had cell phone service and could compare maps options. Instead, that first night, we were left trying to figure out where the heck Google Maps was trying to tell us to go on my phone and my phone alone. And let me tell you, while Google Maps is slightly better than Apple Maps, it is not always the easiest to use in Japan, especially when you have zero idea where you're going because you've just arrived and haven't gotten your bearings yet. Plus, you're lugging two large suitcases and not unhefty backpacks. Let me tell you, while we obviously eventually made it to our hotel, we were hot, our arms and backs hurt from dragging our stuff around, and when it came time for us to head back to the airport about 8 days later, we paid for a dang Uber. And that's my suggestion. If you've just gotten off a lengthy flight and you have suitcases, just pay for an Uber or a taxi, which also, by the way, the taxis have fixed fares to and from the airport like Uber does. Our ride back to the airport cost not quite 9,400 yen, which is just under $60. So sure, a little over three times as much as those bus tickets cost us. But my God, I wish I had just paid for that rideshare or taxi upon arrival too. The only other bus experience we had during our trip was to Tokyo Disneyland, because there's a bus that picks you up again near Shinjuku Station and takes you pretty much right to the park gates, or to the Disney Sea gates if you want to go there first. I bought these tickets through Klook. What is it? Klook? K-L-O-O-K. And they cost maybe $11 or $12 per person. Here's the deal, though. This transportation option is only available to get to the parks. They do have buses that leave at 7:30 or 10:30 a.m. But if you want to have the option of getting any of the premier passes at either park, you need to be on the 7:30 a.m. ones. I'll go into this more when I talk about our Tokyo Disneyland and Disney Sea experiences. But I will say that while the bus wasn't the most comfortable, thankfully it wasn't full, but if it had been, Dean and I, as tall people, would have been very uncomfortably crammed into those seats for the 40-ish minute ride. It was absolutely the most convenient way to get to the parks, and in the end was, I think, only $3 or so more than we paid to get back to our hotel later that night via trains and subways. I guess I shouldn't be surprised that this chapter is longer than I expected, and I haven't even gotten to the trains part of it yet. So I'm going to keep this part short. I keep saying that and then not doing it. Though that's pretty easy, because while Google Maps was not great with showing you where to go on the streets, like seriously, if you stopped to wait for a crosswalk, it would just lose you entirely more often than not. And until we had both phones going and had learned our way around a little bit, like at least in the area where we were staying, we often walked half a block or so in the wrong direction before Google Maps would write itself. It did, however, know what trains to put you on, and when you needed to leave a station, would often even tell you the exit number to look for to get you where you wanted to go faster. Plus, the subways are extremely easy to figure out, especially with Google Maps. The JR trains are a little more difficult because the platform situation is different and the signs aren't as numerous or as clear, but any hiccups we had were extremely minor, and mostly because we didn't actually use the JR trains very much, so we didn't have as many chances to figure them out earlier in our trip. At the very least, we never got on the wrong subway or train, and it was only truly stressful that first day and a half or so when Dean had zero cell phone service and we were still trying to figure out the Suica card situation, which also stemmed from him having no cell phone service. And, yeah. So now that I've waxed on some about how we got around and some about how we didn't get around, I think it's time to talk about something that might cause a few raised eyebrows with Chapter 3, Home is Where the Love Hotel Is. So one thing I hemmed and hawed about and spent a lot of hours researching was a place to stay, especially once I knew we were going to stay in the same hotel for 9 nights straight. I went back and forth between seriously splurging on a room at a Hyatt, mostly for the points as I rack those up at Dragon Con every year as well, or finding something more affordable. And by more affordable, I mean that there were a lot of hotels that were nearly $1,000 less than the Hyatt for the entire stay. And all I could think was, how much time are we going to spend in the room anyway? But the reviews for the hotels that were far less expensive also had some complaints that concerned me. Musty rooms, rooms that were so small and with so little storage space that you couldn't really unpack, but also had nowhere to set or store your suitcases. Or if room size didn't seem to be an issue, they were farther out from the subway or train stations. And I also noticed that many of these hotels listed measurements for their beds. And when I started doing some conversions, because, you know, Americans will use any system of measurement but the metric system, I was seriously concerned about me at nearly 5'9 and Dean at 6'3 booking a room with just one bed that was called a queen, but was smaller than an American full or double or whatever. However, there were a few hotels that kept coming up that had surprisingly good reviews for their prices. I figured they had to be too good to be true, and I suppose if you have qualms about the type of hotels they were, that would be the case. Thankfully, we don't have those qualms, and so we spent less than $1,700 for 9 nights in a Love Hotel in Shinjuku. And if you don't know what a Love Hotel is, well, it's pretty much what it sounds like. It's a hotel with rooms that you can rent for short periods of time to meet with your lover on the sly or sex worker of choice. And let me be very clear that I'm saying this with zero judgment whatsoever. In fact, a friend of mine who is living in Korea had stayed in a Love Hotel there earlier this year and said that if you were okay with the type of hotel it was, at least in Korea, it was well worth staying there for the money you save and was very clean and all that. So I narrowed it down to a couple of different Love Hotels and ended up choosing the Hotel Perrier, and I pretty much have no regrets. Our room was huge. We had a sitting area, a giant bed, a bathroom with a separate vanity area, a toilet in its own little room, and a giant shower and bath area. They provided all sorts of pre-wrapped items, including razors, toothbrushes, mouthwash, loofahs, face masks, face cleanser, toner, and moisturizer, hair oil. I could go on and on and on. If we'd wanted to pay to sing some karaoke in our room, we could. We had a giant spa tub, and yes, I could tell it had been thoroughly cleaned by the way it smelled. Really, the only complaints that I have, if I can even call them that, are that the bed was very hard, which is something that's common in Japan anyway, that every single light in the room was on one switch, so they were either all on or all off, and that while there were several air units in the room, none of them were actually air conditioners, which you wouldn't think would be a problem in late November and early December. But when the window was shut and all of the lights were on, that room could be a hot box. Now, I will say that they could have had the units set to not be actually full AC units because of the time of year, but I would caution that I have no way of knowing that this was the case. So while we were able to cool the room down fairly quickly by opening the window, if it had been summer and those units don't actually work as real AC units at any time, it would probably be miserable. Anyway, I'll end this by saying that overall, we had a great time in that room. There weren't many drawers or anything, and there definitely weren't enough hangers in the closet, but the room was so big and had enough places to drape things over, say, the arm of the couch, or tuck things away, like on the lower shelf of the coffee table, that it didn't really matter. I honestly wouldn't hesitate to book a Love Hotel again, even if it was annoying that we had to turn our key in for like this little business card type thing every time we left, because it was like an actual real room key. So I'm not sure if that's a thing that happens at all Love Hotels or if it was just because this one had actual physical like keys that you turn in a lock. And now that I've talked about how we got around and where we stayed, I think the next most obvious thing is to get into what we ate. Therefore, chapter 4 is sake, snacks, stick food, and other sustenance. Listen, I know that this chapter name begins with sake, but I can't actually kick off my thoughts on our culinary and drinking experiences by talking about that, because it was much later in our trip that I finally sat down and experienced truly good sake and realized what I've been missing out on all these years. I will say that food is one thing I think we missed out on some while we were in Japan. Mostly because we didn't have the time to search out anything specific, particularly the places that I had read about and noted in my little travel notebook that I wanted to try. Also, while I love me some food and to some extent would call myself a foodie, especially after having worked in a variety of restaurants for years as a prep cook and a manager, Dean kind of has a one-track mind when it comes to food. That being, he loves shellfish and doesn't really care about much else. So unfortunately, on this trip, food ended up taking kind of a backseat to all of the other things we wanted to experience. Not completely, of course, but it was more about convenience than going out of our way to eat certain things at certain places. Also, it doesn't help that I do have some food allergies, particularly certain types of shellfish, that limited us some. However, we still got to experience some great food. And I think I have to start with snack options, because if you go to Japan and don't frequent the konbinis, you're seriously missing out. My personal favorite savory snack were the bacon and cream cheese onigiri I got from the 7-Eleven near our hotel. They were a great breakfast time snack to eat as I got ready for the day, and that often carried me over to a more substantial late morning or midday meal. But I also weirdly loved the ice cream options at the konbinis. The little package, sort of, but not really soft serve cones were great. Then I realized they had little Viennetta singles. And I remember the Viennetta logs from my childhood, or at least I'm pretty sure it was logs that Viennetta was served as. But I haven't seen them in longer than I can remember. So I became obsessed with these little Viennetta singles later in our trip. We also bought a couple different types of packaged cheese and mini sausages at konbinis. None of them were all that great, at least in my opinion. But the funniest was the package of cheese that I bought that had zero explanation on it regarding what type of cheese it was. There was a picture on the front of the package of what the mini cheese balls looked like. They're actually kind of shaped like Christmas ornaments. And they were separately wrapped, which was nice. But amusingly, not amuse-bushingly, wow, that was dumb. They tasted just like super processed American cheese. Like if you took a Kraft single and reshaped it into a weird little Christmas ornament shaped ball. Whatever, it was cheese and I still ate them. I also bought a bag of soy sauce and butter flavored chips, having heard that this flavor combination was so delicious. But it was not for me. What was for me was the chiffon cake. The packaged steamed cheesecakes were good as well, but those chiffon cakes were heaven, especially the ones that came chopped into cubes in a container of whipped cream. I'm seriously craving them again as I'm explaining them. Ugh. Seriously, I ate at least 5 containers worth of the cubed chiffon cake and whipped cream while we were there, and now I can't stop thinking about it again. Damn it. Okay. Moving on, because I also had some amazing experiences with what I started calling stick food, which was really just street food, and not all of it was on sticks, but most of the best things we had were still there. Our first experience with stick food was when we were in Yamoto. This is part of the Hakone Golden Course, and I'll talk more about our experiences with that in my next Impulsive Hyperfocus episode. But basically, we were a bit rushed on the tail end of our Golden Course trip because we needed to get back to the Hakone Yamoto station for our train returning to Shinjuku. But we were left with, I think it was like 45 minutes, maybe a little bit more in the town of Yamoto. We had snacked on some delicious black curry buns in the volcanic area. It was one of the ropeway stops on the Golden Course, but we were still hungry. However, also still concerned about time constraints. So I'm super happy that this led to us stumbling upon a little street side window that was selling what I think were called hamburgers on a stick. Was it all beef? I don't recall, to be honest. Whatever it was ground meat served on a stick with some like herbs and spices in it, and it was fucking delicious. We also had little cups of like fried chicken there, which was okay, but it was dark meat, and I don't like dark meat. Sorry, not sorry. Dean loves it, and I know people, I think people say it's like more flavorful or whatever, but I don't like it. I don't like dark meat. So, the little cup of fried chicken was whatever. That hamburger on a stick, though, I wish I knew what they'd used in it, because I would love one right about now. Anyway, the next time we got street food was a couple days later in the Tsujiki Fish Market, which, yes, is touristy. And I'll be honest, not all of the food we tried there was amazing. But Dean was able to get his crab legs that he'd been bugging me about all week. And they were cooked right in front of him. And he, of course, really enjoyed those. We also got a few different kinds of croquettes, and I know Dean enjoyed his seafood one, and we both kind of liked the curry one that I got. The kimchi one wasn't great, and to be honest, I'm not even sure I would get the curry one again. The last thing I tried at the fish market was actually the strawberry tangulu. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but it's T-A-N-G-H-U-L-U. It's frozen candied strawberries on a stick, and this was by far my favorite thing from that day. And then the last full day of our trip, we were at the Sensoji Temple, and there was a row of street food options just outside the temple itself. Dean got some seafood and meat on sticks that he enjoyed, but I tried other things and was basically in love with both of them. First was hashimaki, which is okonomiyaki on a chopstick. It's basically a savory pancake on a stick with 1 to 3 different toppings. In my case, it was like aioli, pickled red ginger, and I think green onions. And after that, I had an actual savory pancake stuffed with chicken and green onions. Also delicious. But honestly, it was hard to beat that pancake on a stick. Like, I wasn't even hungry anymore, but if I had had the proper change on me, I would have gotten another one of those things. So I think that's all of the street food I have to wax on about. One of the other things I wanted to talk about was that I am disappointed in myself for not actually experiencing the Japanese coffee culture. We were so often in a rush early in the day, which meant at best grabbing a coffee at the little chain place near our hotel, and at worst purchasing a little to-go cold coffee from a konbini. And yes, once I did in fact get a Japanese holiday special latte from a Starbucks, something that I'm still a little bit ashamed of, even though I really, really needed both something caffeinated and something hot at that point. So, you know, do what you're gonna do. That said, the chain place near our hotel was a Japanese chain called Dotor, spelled D-O-U-T-O-R, and it was affordable and decent coffee and food. For instance, their croque monsieur, which was of course a fast food version of one and not a really a true French croque monsieur, was, I'm not even sorry to say, freaking delicious. Especially when I, a person who doesn't really love eggs, was either super hungry for a breakfast-ish-y food or just hungover. When it comes to actual meals, setting aside the food we had at Tokyo Disneyland and DisneySea, which I'll talk about a bit in the next episode, our sit-down experiences were kind of a mixed bag. For instance, on our first evening, we were exhausted from our long flight and thought it would be funny to visit a Japanese McDonald's. Dean had a shrimp fillet sandwich, which was just a so-called shrimp version of a fish fillet, and I had the shaka cheeky cheddar cheese, which seemed to be a giant fried chicken patty, but more like a giant chicken nugget than the sandwich patties at McDonald's, maybe, with a cheddar cheese powder you could sprinkle on it. Weirdly enough, I really enjoyed this. I also tried their Senkaku Choco Pie Black, which was a bland chocolate pastry with a sweet chocolate filling. It was okay. Our first actual full sit-down meal was at an izakaya in Shinjuku. It seemed to specialize in small plates, but the whole meal, including one beer each, cost us maybe $40 US, and it was all delicious. Like, I'll be honest, we stumbled on this place kind of later in the evening when we were just trying to get some food in our stomachs after a long day, and I didn't make note of the name, but thanks to some Google image searching and knowing kind of the general area that it was in, I'm about 98% sure it was a restaurant called Toriyoshi Shoten. I think it might be a chain, albeit a small one, but all I know is that we had a delicious and affordable meal there, and I have no regrets. Oh, and this was also the first time we experienced being served a tsukidashi? I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right. I'm trying here. I don't know. The best description I can give is that it's a small dish that is served as sort of an indirect cover charge. In this case, it was a sort of seaweed salad thing, but elsewhere we were served edamame at a sake bar and literally just popcorn at one of the bars in Golden Guy. Oh, and at a cocktail bar, dried fruit and nuts. Anyway, tsukidashi aside, getting back on the places we stumbled into tech, both ramen places that we ate at fit into this category. The first one was apparently a chain ramen place and a touristy one at that, which I only found out after the fact, honestly. I'm pretty sure it was called Ichiran, and honestly, we just needed some food after a long day of just kind of snacking. It was in a basement, actually very close to the Godzilla Head in Shinjuku. There were quite a few locals there, and we waited less than 15 minutes to be seated at around 5:30 or 6 p.m. on, I believe it was Monday of our trip. And maybe it was my choices in terms of broth richness, spiciness, and toppings, but that was far and away the best ramen I've had ever in my life. And also, it was like a full-on experience, including the Japanese man directly behind me who was slurping and burping away. Unfortunately, because that ramen was so amazing, when we wandered into another ramen place, I believe it was Kamakura Ramen, also in Shinjuku, on our last night, it wasn't hard to be disappointed simply based on their watery broth. But what you gonna do? The other two restaurants we sat down to eat at were both near our hotel. The first one was called Kyushu Ramen Hakatako, I believe. And I definitely enjoyed the meal I had there, but to be fair, I have to admit that it came at the end of a late night out that featured plenty of drinks, so my memory of how good it was is probably a bit skewed by that. The other one near our hotel was like a few blocks away, and we basically just went into it one night because we needed quick sustenance again after a long day. And while it was packed with locals, I was completely unimpressed with the katsu I had. It was way more greasy than I expected or would have liked, so unfortunately nothing about it bears mentioning in like a positive manner, which is why I'm not even saying its name, honestly. Anyway, as I mentioned earlier in this chapter, such as it is, as someone who had never really understood the whole sake obsession, actually going to Japan and visiting a sake bar in the Nakano Broadway area seriously changed my life, at least in terms of sake. This was a place where we were able to ask the server what sake she would suggest, and weirdly enough, it turned out that she had gone to the U.S. for school and lived in Virginia while she was here, not far from where I went to school. So yeah, that was a fun little conversation. Plus, she gave us the best suggestion, and that led to me not just drinking that sake, but ordering it again several times that night. And I only regret not going to a proper sake bar earlier in the week. Though we did have one other truly amazing bar experience. This was at a place called Memento Mori. And to be honest, it's in kind of a weird location. It's in a corner of an upper floor of the Toranomon Hills Business Tower. But when I say that this is an experience that's worth having, I mean it more than I can probably even explain in a short little recap podcast like this. The drinks there are all cacao-based. The bartenders are extremely attentive and knowledgeable, and it was probably the most amazing experience we had drinking in Tokyo. They explain every drink to you. There are plenty of options no matter what your taste. And while it's one of the more pricey drinking experiences I think you can probably have in Tokyo, it is worth every penny. I don't know how common it is to have such a specifically themed bar with such very specifically themed drinks in Japan, but while Dean and I didn't love one of the three, I think, that he ordered, I had the main tasting flight and loved all of it. Although, to be honest, I don't love calling it a flight because it consisted of two full-sized drinks followed by an actual flight of three shots of infused liquor. And actually, right after we visited Memento Mori, we wandered over to a brewery that wasn't far away. It's called Kunisawa Brewing. It's in this narrow little building, and it also houses a printing press, weirdly enough. It's very, very bespoke, so much so that they actually note that it is bespoke on their coasters. I want to say I tried both an IPA and a pale ale. I do know that the two beers I had there, they were like just okay. Dean did have a sour that he loved. And he also got a little seafood dish that he said was delicious. But one thing about the beer in Japan, I've always found Sapporo and Kirin to be just fine. But except for a couple local brews we tried, including at this little place in Yamato at the end of our previously mentioned Hakone Golden Course Day. Again, more on that full experience in the next episode. And of course, in Tokyo at Kunisawa that I just mentioned, plus Ginza Lion Beer Hall and the Toranomon Brewery as well. Most times we ordered a beer, there were very few choices and often just one choice, which in those cases was Asahi, always the kind labeled super, quote, dry, unquote. Seriously, I don't know. I think maybe Asahi like means dry, maybe. I tried Googling it and that's what it looked like. But I just found it so funny that their beer, the actual label and like the labeled glasses that bars and restaurants had that were Asahi glasses literally said super. And then under it, in quotes, just the word dry. I don't know. Whatever. It amused me a lot. But this beer, it was better than, I don't know, like a Bud or a Miller Lite or one of those equally overpresent American beers here in the U.S. So like, at least it was better than that. You know, it wasn't great beer, but it was cheap too. So there's that. Anyway, I think that kind of wraps up chapter 4, because that's basically all of the food and drink experiences that we had that are worth mentioning. Oh, with the exception of, I forgot to mention the volcanic smoked eggs that you can buy in Hakone, which were disgusting in my opinion. Dean liked them just fine, but they just tasted like very smoky hard-boiled eggs and not really good to me. So yeah, those are the first 4 chapters worth of information that I wanted to cover about our trip. The next Impulsive Hyperfocus episode will cover at least 4 more chapters, I believe. I'm going to break down our 3 main tourist experiences that we had in chapters 5, 6, and 7. And then I think there's just going to kind of be like a hodgepodge conclusion chapter. And I know it's a little bit weird that I'm calling these chapters, but I do what I want. So yeah, stay tuned for more about our Japan trip in the next Impulsive Hyperfocus episode. And in conclusion, thank you for listening to my first ever travel-centric podcast episode. As always, if you have any thoughts on personal stories of mine you're interested in hearing or any particular rants or rambles you'd like me to go on, send me a DM at ageeksaga on Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, or Threads. Or, of course, you can email me at ageeksaga@gmail.com. Also, definitely follow me on the aforementioned social media accounts for the most current news and updates about this series. And please consider backing our Patreon at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment for early access to not just these Impulsive Hyperfocus episodes, but also to the other Geek Saga podcast series that we're currently working on.